more space reading wrecks and moving AI off the planet. You are listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Catching up on your to-be-read list this summer? Well, how about adding one more to the stack? This one's a science fiction thriller series set in space. When Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield returned to Earth after traveling to the International Space Station, he found a new mission in writing. We'll revisit a conversation with Hadfield about his series based on the Cold War and space race to the moon, and how his time in space shaped his writing. Then, what's better than a new pair of sneakers? How about ones that were designed off this planet? We'll speak with Scintillae's Ben Weiss about the prospects of moving design into orbit. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Well, it's summer, and it's a time for some of us to relax and dive into those hobbies we may have missed throughout the school year, including reading for fun. And if you don't know what book to pick up, think about a science fiction thriller series by Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. His series is set during the Cold War and the space race to the moon. The first book is The Apollo Murders, followed by The Defector. And later this year, he'll have a third book out called Final Orbit, completing the series. But how did Hadfield go from space travel to space fiction writing? Well, we spoke with Hadfield about his new mission in writing earlier this year. Here's part of that conversation now.
Well, Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm really pleased to be speaking with you again.
Yeah, and the last time we had you on, your book, The Darkest Dark, was out. Since then, there have been plenty of other books. You've been quite a prolific writer. Tell me a bit about your journey from astronaut to writer.
Well, I'm still very much an astronaut, working with space companies, director of several companies, technology incubator, super busy on the technical side. But it's really great to be able to share the experience through writing as well. Darkest Dark, the one you mentioned, that was a children's book. And, you know, it's easy to write a lousy children's book. It's hard to write a good one. And we worked really hard. And we didn't, it was the fourth children's book I wrote, I think, but the only one we published. And it's done great. And I just love the anecdotal stories from all around the world of the kids that are understanding space flight and how not to be afraid. And so I love the idea of trying to share ideas through writing. And now writing fiction with the Apollo Murders series, and most recently, the book that just came out two or three months ago, The Defector. It's a great, you know, personal challenge to write thriller fiction, but it's also having terrific success. And it's a really fun way to let people in on the nitty gritty of what space flight and being a combat fighter pilot and test pilot is really like.
I have to say, every kid that I know in my life got a copy of The Darkest Dark after I got a copy from you, and they have enjoyed it very much. So thank you for that. But let's talk about, you mentioned that there is a challenge in writing thriller fiction. Had you always had this interest in writing, Chris, or is this something that relatively new for you?
You know, where did your dreams come from when you think about it? A lot of it came from media of some sort, right? You went and saw a movie, or you read a story, or somebody read a story to you, or you watched a video or something. Because in your normal mundane day-to-day life, you know, growing up, going to school, whatever, on the ball team, you don't think about the universe and superheroes and exploring stars and stuff nearly as much. But that comes to you through fiction or through media. And for me, some of those early comic books and then movies and TV shows and science fiction books, they were absolutely critical in giving me the idea that maybe some of this stuff could actually happen in my life, that this sort of thing wasn't just a fantasy, but this is a real life part of what goes on. And so to be able to link those together, I've always found really important as a reader and a consumer. And now at this stage of life, where I've had a lot of those experiences, it's just as much fun to try and be someone who's providing those ideas, whether it's, you know, playing guitar in a space station or making TV series, or now writing nonfiction and thriller fiction. And what I love the most is a really good gripping thriller fiction book, you know, where I'm like sitting somewhere boring, but I'm having this huge adventure in my head because of what's written on the page that nobody around me is having. And I've always loved that type of escapism that a book can give you And when it's tied to real events and real history and you learn stuff and you feel like you're emerged from some amazing experience when you turn the last page, that's the type of book I wanted to be able to write. And that's the task I gave myself. And it's great to see the huge success that the Apollo murders has had and now The Defector is having. And it's, you know, it's inspired me to start working on the third book in the series.
I want to talk about those books in a minute. But first, what is your approach to writing? You know, as a writer myself, I approach things, you know, my way. With your background as an engineer, how do you bring in some of that to the way that you write? Like, I'm assuming that your plots are like engineering diagrams. You know, is that the way that you approach writing?
When I first went to space, we were going to help build a Russian space station, Mir, and we launched without a flight plan. If you can believe it, because things were changing so rapidly and there were so many unknowns that we had a big skill set, but we did not have a plot yet. Even though we were nothing but a bunch of engineers and scientists. And I think it's sort of like that, in that what you got to do is gather all of the threads of possibility and then do a whole bunch of research so that you've got the capability to put it all together when you have to. But then you've just got to start writing. That's what I've learned. And I'm sure you know the same thing. And when you start writing fiction, you're going to put yourself into corners immediately where now, what would my characters do next? And shoot, now I got to look, I didn't even know they do that. But that's obviously what those people would do next. And now I've got to solve all that. And so no, what I have as someone with my background is I have the general arc and I've got enough loose threads that I'm pretty sure I can weave it all together. I've got the major signposts of history of the period that I'm setting the book in. And then there's an enormous amount of research of digging out stories and digging out details. And then when I start writing, now it's weaving it all together and turning it into something that is factually true, but also, you know, a gripping page turner if I can make it happen. So that's the process. And I try and write about 1,000 words on my writing days. Do it in the morning because by the afternoon my brain is full, and I'm a constant back editor. Like I read what I wrote the last couple of days, and then I, you know, I'll probably go change some stuff there, and then I start writing and I'll write full of blurb, and then I go back and read it and fix some stuff. So it's a very iterative process. But that's how the five books have gotten written so far. And that's the process I'm going through on the sixth right now.
Yeah. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Right. It seems to be working quite well. So let's talk about the success with Apollo Murders and the new book, the Defector. Where did this idea come from? I hope it's not something that happened in space to you personally.
What I did when I thought, okay, I'm going to try and write thriller fiction is I went back and reread what I think is the really good thriller fiction, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and go back and read Robert Ludlum and Ken Follett and James Bond and John D. MacDonald with the Travis McGee series and Dick Francis with his whole series and Jonathan Kellerman and Lee Child. Read all those, you know, but read them like an engineer would read them. How did they choose words? How did they attribute sentences? How long were their paragraphs? How did they reveal the plot? Like, it's a real structural, clinical thing to learn how to do that. And so for me, trying to learn the skill was a really important part of tasking myself with putting it together. And then, of course, everybody needs a good editor. I read Stephen King's book on writing, and it was hugely permission giving because he included a big blurb of his raw writing, and it was terrible. Like, it was bad sentence structure, poor thought processes, but the raw materials were there. And it just demonstrated how the creative spark and the raw work needs to be done. But then you need a good editor to come in and say, hey, you know, we don't need all these words and you should trim this. Just like a movie director and a film editor have an absolutely necessary relationship. You need that too. So yeah, I'm learning as I go, try and get more efficient at it. So it's not a matter of not broke, don't fix it. It's a matter of something that's working, keep trying to fine tune it.
So tell us about the new book, The Defector. Give us a quick elevator pitch as to what the synopsis is and the intrigue this book promises to give.
Sure. It's the fall of 1973, a height of the Cold War, the end of the Apollo era, and topically right now, conflict in the Middle East, and a Soviet fighter, the top, the fastest, highest flying fighter ever built, suddenly defects into Israel. And Israel trades it with the United States in order to support what's going on. And it ends up out in the desert in Nevada, where all of the confiscated Soviet fighters were at the time, at a place called Area 51. And not only does the fighter come in there, but the pilot, who's a Soviet test pilot, is brought out there to help teach the U.S. military what to do with this airplane. But the real crux of the story is the interplay between my protagonist, Kaz Zemeckis, who's also a test pilot and fighter pilot, and what the real purpose of that airplane defecting and what the real point of trying to get to Nevada was. That's the crux of the defector. And it leads to the big, super heavy action scene at the end of Great Conflict, and hopefully setting the stage for the third book in the series.
Chris, most people will remember you from the time you created a music video from the International Space Station, Space Oddity. It was brilliant. It was wonderful. It was inspiring. So it goes as no surprise that you are getting into TV as well. Tell me a bit about how you're now going from writing books to getting into television.
Well, I've done several series, National Geographic and BBC and things like that. But when Sylvester Stallone and his wife, Jennifer, read The Apollo Murders, they loved it. And I was already working with a production house in the UK called Altitude. But Sly Stallone, he actually called me one day and said he'd pitched my book to Amazon without even asking me. And so now his production house, which he calls Balboa Productions, naturally, and the production house in the UK, they've signed together and they are working now on bringing The Apollo Murders to be a television series. And so writing continuing books in that series makes sense. I'm super excited. I'm now an executive producer. I don't even know what that is, but I'll figure it out. I figured out how to command a space station. We'll figure this out. But it's super exciting. Who'd have thought that this might be possible? But fundamentally for me, it's another whole way to really richly share the amazing experience of flying in space. And yeah, a lot, you know, everything that's in these books is credible, but fortunately, those weren't things that happened to me. But I think that tenuous link between amazing possibility and the reality of stuff that actually happens, that's where the whole crux of these books and the TV series, that's the whole secret sauce of them.
And Chris, in the minute we have left here, I am reminded in this conversation of something you told me when we talked about The Darkest Dark, and it's not to be afraid, to take risks. And it seems like that has what has been your success in this next portion of your career. Is that the message that you want to tell people out there, is to just try, to go for it?
Well, you've got to take care of business. You've got to honor all your obligations. You need to take care of self, family, friends, you know, all your day-to-day stuff. But there's some freestyle time every day. And life is a daring adventure or nothing. You get one. 30,000 days. What are you going to do with those days? How far are you going to try and push your own capabilities? What, when you look back at the end of the month or the year or the decade, what are you going to be proudest of? What are you going to regret not doing? To me, I think you should constantly be challenging yourself to grow and improve your own skill set and try stuff you've never tried before. My wife is doing her fifth university degree right now. And to me, that's the very essence of a life well lived.
That was Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. He famously filmed a music video from orbit performing David Bowie's Space Oddity. He's also the author of The Apollo Murders, The Defector, and soon to come, Final Orbit. If you want to read more about space, check out our website for a list of books from authors we featured on Are We There Yet? Check out our space reading list at cfpublic.org/space. So to come, from space books to space shoes.
We can design a parachute in space and something you can put on and look at that wasn't made on Earth. You have an easy way to relate to it and to maybe be inspired by what's possible in space. And, you know, that's part of the mission here. It's like, let's ignite the interest in more of a practical sense for a newer generation.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. As humanity moves towards commercializing space and building an economy in low Earth orbit, one company is trying to profit from both on-planet and off-planet with shoes designed in space. The Florida-based company Syntellae uses AI technology up there and 3D printing down here. By 2026, the company hopes to have fully designed a shoe in low Earth orbit and have them ready to sell the same year. So how does this process work, and why send it to space, and what other industries might take advantage of orbital design? Well, here to answer those questions and talk more about the company's mission is Syntellae's CEO, Ben Weiss. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
having me. Great to be here.
Great to chat with you, Ben. I want to first start talking about your company and how did it get involved in 3D printing and AI technology for the start?
It's been a couple year journey. I mean, we've been thinking about what's possible with AI design and 3D printing for a bit. And we initially started with the idea of backing content creators with shoes. You know, why can't the YouTube, TikTok, Twitch generation get their own shoes like the athletes get? They've got just as much influence. They sell millions of dollars of merchandise. They've had shirts, shorts, hoodies, and everything else under the sun. Why don't they get the opportunity to be in this category of footwear? And it's just because the costs are so high and the time frame to make something is so long. It's a year and a half generally to make a new shoe, and it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Your mold cost can range from $2,000 to $4,000 per size. You have to make a mold for every size, got minimum inventory requirements. And so we're like, there's got to be a better way. The founder of Reebok and I and some other people on our team brought out basically a different process using AI design and 3D printing. And we showed the world that you can make shoes like this that are commercially available. And earlier in the year, in January, we debuted this. In February, it fully came out as the first AI design slide shoe you can get. And it became a breaking news story on the front page of USA Today and in many other papers, because now there's a new path to getting a shoe that takes 3 months to make one and is 1/100th of the cost. And so we're like, what can we do more with AI design and 3D printing and specifically AI design? Well, we can make shoes in space because we're automating a lot of our design, and that's how we're here.
Let's talk about the space portion of this. Why is it important to towards low Earth orbit for your business model here? Why even make designs in space to begin with?
I mean, you can say, look, like this is an interesting press kind of related subject, like making shoes in space. It's a big headline. It's a lot deeper than that. And it goes into two different segments. One is that there isn't really a way to relate to space right now for a lot of younger people, specifically Gen Z. We hear about, you know, different aspects of budget for space and the moon base and Mars and all these ambitious projects. But, you know, a lot of the innovations that have come through space exploration, like the drill and the memory foam mattress and the way our cameras are designed, the compact aspects of them have been met from many years ago and from attempting to do different missions and from going on certain missions. But in recent history, we haven't really had a way for younger people to relate to space. Well, if we can design a parachute in space and something you can put on and look at that wasn't made on Earth, you have an easy way to relate to it and to maybe be inspired by what's possible in space. And, you know, that's part of the mission here. It's like, let's ignite the interest in more of a practical sense for a newer generation. There's also the piece of we have a process to design shoes currently that require 4 different steps. And it's automated, but there's still human intervention. We have concept image creation with AI. We have pattern and texture creation with AI. We have 3D shape that's made that AI generates. And we also have shading that AI helps with. And we have a human move along these steps and influence these steps. But what if we can automate that a lot more? Space is the best opportunity to test that out because of our constraints with compute power and other avenues. You know, now we can just go and test out our process a lot further and condense it. Can we go from a concept image creation to a 3D model entirely in space? That will improve our process here on Earth a lot more, making shoes, make them more cost effective, and be able to make products much faster. So we think it's going to improve our process and our AI automation in general because of the unique opportunity space presents with its constraints and limitations.
So essentially, you are challenging yourself because space is hard. you have no access to the hardware once it's launched, and there are constraints, as you mentioned, like bandwidth constraints, power constraints, and all that. So this is essentially a way for you to better your process, is what I'm hearing, right?
Yeah, that's the goal. It's like, can we improve our automation process? Because we're trying to become the content creator shoe brand. We're trying to back brands with their own shoes that have never done them before. And the faster and more cost effective we can make our design process, which, you know, currently today is doing a lot of different sketches, which can take a lot of time. You have to do many revisions of sketches to get to a point where you're happy. And then you have to make a 3D model by hand. We generate a 3D model. We generate our concept image artwork instead of making sketches and then just make a sketch based on a finalized concept that we've created with AI. So if we can condense this process even further, it's just going to present an opportunity for more content creators and more brands to get into the coveted footwear category with original designs. And it's going to really ignite a whole new creative sensation in this space. This space is ready for some new ideas. A lot of the bestsellers today are 50, 60 year old silhouettes.
There's also kind of another practical reason to bring this off orbit, right? I mean, the technology that you need to run AI is very resource intensive. Is there a benefit to getting this technology and this process off the planet and into low Earth orbit?
It's going to be something that is going to be better overall for the environment to automate our processes in space. I mean, it's not like our process is insanely compute intensive currently on Earth. It's something that we can, you know, can be better overall by running it outside of Earth from an energy standpoint. I mean, this is also part of the reason why we're partnered with Copernic Space, which is a space blockchain platform that's helping us with the mission. And the shoes will be available for purchase through their platform as a claimable space authenticated asset, because their mission is to test up new use cases in space, whether for them it's about, you know, compute for mining cryptocurrency or creation of new different types of structures of materials or things like that. What can we find out? Can space provide a lot of benefits in that really hasn't been, you know, tested before? I mean, that's also part of the interest here, is like, what will space do for footwear design? We haven't really had any, you know, ability to test that before. And now, because of the opportunity that they provide with us in partnership of this ability to do something commercially in space outside of being a typical, you know, science experimentation focused company of developing new drugs or medicines or things like that, you know, we can now figure out what shoe design can in space looks like, and, you know, how that benefits people and how that benefits our own process. I mean, it's really an unknown category right now. We don't even necessarily know all the different positives that can come from it.
You mentioned that this could be very resource intensive, right? With AI and the company you're partnering with crypto mining, and bringing this into space kind of mitigates some of those environmental impacts. How much do we know about that? It seems like your use case is on the kind of the front lines of exploring a new way to do these very resource intensive processes. What do we know about this, and what are you hoping to find out that you can bring back to the greater good and say, you know, these are some of the things that we can do to lessen our carbon footprint with these processes?
I mean, I think my knowledge on this area is fairly limited because it isn't really my focus so much, but I do know that it is the process, you know, there is intensity to the traditional AI design process. And there is a certain output that is done through that that can be minimized by being in space. Now, there's also the production aspect of this with 3D printing. And there's that, you know, there's that whole side of what output that has, which we've tried to be as eco-friendly as we possibly can. Like our shoes today, you can send them back to us. We can melt them down and make them into a new one. They're entirely recyclable, which is such a rare feat for the space. And we only print when somebody orders one. So we print on demand, so we don't have all this excess inventory. So in general, like our footprint, we've tried to be as smart and as cautious about how we're doing things as we possibly can. When it comes to design, I think that because of the constraints in space, whether it's the compute power, whether it's the ability for us to upload new models to space, like we're setting up one model over here initially, one agent, you know, we're going to be able to send up multiple different ones throughout the course of this satellite being in space, which this computer is going to be there for at least a year. And, you know, we're going to learn from the first experiment and see, you know, what works and what doesn't work, how much our energy output, you know, our energy uses it really is, and what our output we get from that becomes. And then we're going to tweak things and change things as we go. So it's very much going to be a learning process for us, because there isn't really any case study of anything like this ever done before. And we're going to keep experimenting till we figure out what is the most optimal way to design something from an energy efficient standpoint, from a result standpoint, from an appeal in terms of the look, and a lot of other categories too. It's going to be a lot of learning.
Ben, you mentioned this has never been done before. This is a novel idea. But what you are working on down here on Earth is new and a novel idea, right? You're using AI to design these shoes that are manufactured through 3D printing. But you're also getting the chance to incorporate some sort of low Earth orbit aspects, utilizing the space economy to do this. Did you ever think when you started this company that you would have access to a satellite? And what does that show you about just how kind of flexible the new space economy is?
This is something I've been talking to Grant, who founded Copernic Space, about for like 3 years, I think, at this point. We've been going back and forth about all different types of space ideas. And now we're working with them on three different missions. This is the first one that's announced, but we're doing something, you know, that will go further than even this in terms of distance. And we have a bunch of other interesting ideas. And I mean, this is kind of his mission, is like to make space accessible to everybody, because it just hasn't been. And I think part of the reason space has been like so questioned by some people and just people are unaware of the benefits is because it's been so in the category of really like deep science. And it needs to just expand outside of that. It needs to expand commercially in consumer products, which is what we're the first company to do really in this space, to design something, you know, in space and then make it commercially available to anybody. Anybody can purchase something made in space. It's a pretty interesting and different thing. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do here. I think that Copernic Space has been very helpful with that. Orbit's Edge as well. We have a great factory partner, Zellerfeld. And just, you know, when you bring on the founder of Reebok to your team, you have Joe Foster, who built the company from nothing to the best-selling shoe brand in the world and has helped create some of these iconic silhouettes and then to take his talents and to help make something in space, you know, it just becomes an entirely different type of product, something really special and unique and a symbol of the future. And that's what we're trying to do, is to be the difference and to bring this design by tomorrow mentality to the masses. So I think the space is something that, like, it was on our minds initially. We were thinking about it, but now, I mean, it's like, this is real and this is practical. And I think that's so exciting because we've been trying to find a way to do something practical in the space, and designing in space is something what I think we're the only ones really capable of in this footwear category, because we're the only ones designing real shoes today that are made by AI that you can get. I mean, everyone else, it's human designers. So we can actually do something like this and expand our process.
We've been talking a lot about the long-term future. I want to talk about the short-term future. When does this platform launch, and how excited are you and your team to see something that you are working on literally leave this planet?
We are so excited. I mean, Joe, the founder of Reebok, has been talking a lot about how he wants to go to space. I mean, just how we should do something in space. And now we're doing it. So it's incredible to really materialize this. I mean, the launch is going up on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket in early 2026. Planet is Q1. And then our goal is to launch these shoes available for sale at, you know, $200 price point or so around Q2. So we're really trying to get that all up and running, and which means our AI developments have to be, you know, have to keep increasing, have to go further along. So we're currently working on developing this AI agent. So there's still a bunch of things that need to be done before this is fully ready to go and all of that. But it's just such an exciting process to materialize this and to make it real and to bring this out to the world.
One final question. I promise this is the actual final question. As you're designing this AI agent to make this design, are you instructing it to maybe nod to its orbital origins? Will there be something on this shoe that will show that it was made in space?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I can't disclose yet. We're thinking about different interesting ideas. I've even, like, we're thinking about ideas about even how to incorporate the environment in space into the design itself. You know, there's interesting patterns or ways we can develop, you know, designs based on the surroundings. So there's a lot of really exciting ideas. We're in the process of determining how we're going to possibly do some of these things, but it needs to be something that stands out. If space shoes they've got to live up to the name, you know, they've got to be something different.
Ben Weiss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Scintillet's CEO, Ben Weiss. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode. But before we end the show, this summer, join the Central Florida Public Media family. We're aiming for 100 new or rejoining monthly sustainers to support the independent news and programs, just like this one, that you love. Become a sustainer and get a special thank you gift. We got things like umbrellas or a travel mug. Find out more at cfpublic.org, and thanks. And if you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR's app, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show on social media. Our handle on Instagram and Facebook is at @AWTYspace. If you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern this summer is Ashley Reap. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from you, our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.